The Seth Leibson Show, where it's principles, not politics. Now, here's Seth.
Welcome back. Thursday, May 12th, 2016. Hope you're having a safe drive home from work, or if you work the night shift, a safe drive to work. It's been a long time coming. I've wanted this guest. I've heard him on some other shows, and I was just recently familiarizing myself with the whole warp and woof of his biography, and his name is Christopher Malagisi. He is the editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club, but that title doesn't even come close to all the accomplishments and issues he is steeped in with regard to the conservative movement. Regular listeners to this show know how much I do with people like Chris Buskirk or Tevi Troy on the history of the conservative movement. He's actually also a professor in the history of the conservative movement over at American University. When you are the editor-in-chief of Conservative Book Club and you teach at something called American University, you've got my attention. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. That's a heck of an introduction.
Well, it's earned and deserved. But in that you are a first-time guest, let me let you do a little bit of an autobiography. I always ask my first-time guests pretty much a similar question. It's not what Hugh Hewitt asks them, so I'm not going to ask you if Alger Hiss was guilty or if you read The Looming Tower, but I am going to ask you if you would just tell us how you grew up and how you where you grew up and how you came to be doing what you're doing.
Well, I'm originally from Buffalo, New York. We love our Buffalo Wings, and we love losing Super Bowls.
Jack Kemp.
And Jack Kemp,
yes. Okay.
Very, very proud of being from Jack Kemp's district. But yeah, I grew up a Greek family. My grandparents came overseas from Greece after World War II and grew up there. And politics was not something that was shied away from at a dinner table conversation. It was almost encouraged. And I just was always involved in public service and wanted to get involved more. Came to D.C. and went to American University for undergrad and Syracuse University for graduate degree and master's of public administration. And as you mentioned in my bio, I kind of had a shift from working on campaigns, presidential campaigns, to doing more of the kind of more the intellectual conservatism side of things, and got very much interested in intellectual conservatism, first principles, and like you did a Claremont Institute Fellowship, which is a wonderful organization that teaches people about the Constitution and the role of citizen and statesman. And now doing teaching at American University as an adjunct professor of history of the conservative movement. Ran CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, a few years ago, and now I'm editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club.
Well, I got to tell you what a thirst there is out there for this. So a relatively obscure political philosopher who became more famous really in his death than in his life, at least beyond his regular students, was the man who taught me everything I know, a man named Harry Jaffa. Mm-hmm. And just as you're saying this, what's interesting to me is I had a friend of mine, another student of his, named Chris Buskirk on the show the other day, along with someone you must know named Steve Hayward, you must know Steve. So he was on the show, and we did an hour talking about the teachings of Harry Jaffa, because we kept mentioning him over the past several months, and people said, tell us more. And my friend Chris just emailed me just today that the episode we did on Harry Jaffa with Steve Hayward was the highest downloaded podcast by far. He takes our appearances on radio and turns them into his own podcast. He said it was the highest listened to podcast by far of anything he's ever published. So there is this tremendous thirst out there, untapped by too many, I think. Not you, hopefully not me. But a tremendous thirst for serious political science, serious political philosophy, serious conservative thought.
Well, I'm pleased that that something like that would be the most downloaded exchange that you'd have. It says a lot about your audience.
No, well, you know what I think it says? Sure, to be sure, and we'll take the compliment, obviously. But you know what else I think it says? It says something David McCullough learned, the historian. We know that for all the lamenting we do about how poorly American students do in math and reading when we look at NAEP or the nation's report card. The thing they do the worst in is actually American history. Their scores in American history are actually worse than even reading and math. But what David McCullough found through his books and, gosh knows, through that John Adams movie series on Showtime is that people do crave it. They crave it. They're still thirsty for it. Maybe they have to wait till they're adults to get it. But there is a reason that he can have monumental bestsellers on parts of American history or turn John Adams's life into a Showtime hit, you know?
Oh, I agree.
And the same is with Real Teaching. I guess that I didn't make the connection to Jaffa. No. So the same is with real serious scholarship on issues having to do with the founding or the Civil War or Lincoln or political philosophy, conservatism. The same thing is true. It's a down market commodity in K through 12 and in most undergraduate courses, but when presented to them as a real, live, meaningful thing, they want it.
Yeah, and I'd even go a step further and say that, you know, I begin my class that I teach at American called History of the Conservative Movement with asking my students a question. What are conservatives inherently trying to conserve? Because it's conserve, what are we trying to conserve here? And it's very interesting to get the answers from the students about this. But at the end of the day, you know, the answer is they're trying to conserve our first principles. They're trying to conserve the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and those type of ideas. And it's almost, you know, ingrained in us. So being conservative is not necessarily even political. It's just that's the foundation. That's where we came from. And it's all the strife from left and right and all the stuff we see on cable news and all the division that you were talking about, you know, I sometimes wonder, well, why don't we get back to basics and start with the things that we should be agreeing upon, which is the Constitution, and work from there. And I think that's where we need to get back to get past a lot of this strife.
Professor Malagisi, one of the things I like that you just said, amongst everything you just said, was that being conservative isn't necessarily political. I don't know in my whole life if I've ever heard that sentence, and yet I agree with it fully, because it does take you back to first principles, if that is what you're trying to conserve, and I don't know what else there is worth conserving, right? What else would you want to conserve? But first principles should not be political. This goes back to what Jefferson said in his inaugural address. I'll butcher it a little bit, but get it pretty close to right, pretty close to literal, when he said, every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We're all Republicans. We're all Federalists. Because we should all agree on principle issues, concepts of liberty and equality, self-evident truths, and that which was we, the people, that the Constitution spoke of in its preamble, or the same we in the Declaration, the one people in the Declaration of Independence, right? These were things we all agreed on, and somehow I don't know that that's true anymore. I think getting to the idea of conserving first principles is a great question, and then we have to go back and define first principles, don't we?
We do, and I think you hit the nail on its head earlier when you said that, you know, the focus so much is on STEM classes,
yeah,
the sciences,
yeah,
the maths, and the, you know, and they've forgotten about the history. They've forgotten about what makes good governance. What? How do you have an act? How do you have self-governance without an active and educated citizenry?
Right.
And I think we've moved away from that because of all these testings and STEM stuff. And I think you're absolutely right. I think we need to get back to just teaching basic civics in our all the way, you know, even from elementary school on. By the time they get to college, it's almost too late.
Yeah.
I'll give you one example.
Sure.
There was so also in the beginning of my class, I also do an unofficial survey, and I'm curious. I asked my students; these were upperclassmen students, sophomores, juniors, seniors, and they're at a pretty prestigious school, a political science program, political science majors. And I asked them, "How many of you have actually read the entire Declaration of Independence and the Constitution?"
Zero.
Which Well, no, not that bad. Not that bad. About half of them.
Really?
Half of them.
Okay.
It was just kind of amazing that these guys, some of them were seniors in college and had never been asked in any of their classes to sit, which really is not that long. I mean, it's not a very long document.
No.
I mean, you could sit down in one sitting and read both,
yes,
Declaration and the Constitution. And so it's like, man, my class, it became more about teaching about the founding and the Constitution to explain modern conservatism. I had to go all the way back to the founding for it.
You are, among other things, the editor of the Conservative Book Club, and I want to talk about some of that because you guys have done some great work, yeoman's work, in publishing the kinds of works that take us back to those first principles. So I want to learn what's on your book, your bestseller list this week, and we're going to get into some of that. There's a book you just put out which goes to everything we were talking about, which I'm totally curious about and plan to read this weekend, Passing on the Right, Conservative Professors in the Progressive University, which I'd like to do a whole show on, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. In fact, tell us what's on the bestseller list this week, and then I want to get to the Conservative Professors in the Progressive University.
Sure. I mean, for your audience, and the Conservative Book Club is essentially a national conservative book club for people that are interested in conservative authors and books, and we jokingly call ourselves the Oprah Winfrey Book Club for the Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it functions like a Goodreads or IMDb.com. We have a database of books and authors. We have new releases, sneak previews, original author interviews, and one of the things we do is put together a bestseller list each week, which is based on real Nielsen book scan numbers, not fuzzy math that goes on at the New York Times. We actually use real hard numbers in determining our bestseller list. And from there, we put together a list every week. It comes out every Thursday, a top 10 list. And, you know, how we define conservative is somewhat big tent, but really more if a book has a focus on promoting individual liberty, a free market economy, traditional values, strong national defense, and promoting the civil society, those books meet our insertion criteria. So we try our best in the pantheon of books to make sure that we include all those in our list.
We are going to go – I love that list. I was just taking notes on it. Notions of liberty, free markets, national defense – civil society, not a bad thing to keep our minds focused on. Not a bad time to have you talk about what's on that list this week, because people are starting to look at what they want for their summer reading. We'll be right back with Christopher Malagisi, editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club. You can go to their website to get everything he just said, theconservativebookclub.com. And when I come back, I'm going to ask you how Malagisi is a Greek name. Among other things, we'll be right back. Delighted to have Christopher Malagisi, editor of the Conservative Book Club, with us talking about not just books, but conservatism and conservative books. What is on the bestseller list? How is Malagisi a Greek name? That's what I promised to ask you. I'd like to know that. Then I'd like to know what's on the bestseller list for this week.
Well, I'm technically part Muggle here.
Okay.
I'm 75% Greek, 25% Italian. The Malagisi name comes from the Italian side.
All right, they got the 25%
cut the name, right?
So, oh yeah, okay, that'll do it. Yeah,
that'll do it.
that now I'm convinced. Okay, having cleared that deck, would you please tell me what is on the list this week, brother?
Sure. Do you want to start at the bottom?
Yeah, let's go 10-1. Let's do it like Letterman.
All right. Now, number 10 on the list this week is Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War by Sebastian Gorka. For people who may not be familiar with him, he's one of the country's leading counterterrorism experts and has an interesting thesis that in order to win the war on terror, you can't just use guns and bombs. You've got to use psychological warfare, too, and just a very interesting read. Number 9 is True Reagan, What Made Ronald Reagan Great and Why It Matters by James Rosebush, who is the former chief of staff for Nancy Reagan, mm-hmm, and senior advisor to President Reagan. Interesting book that, yes, there's tons of books on Reagan, but this book in particular talks about the leadership qualities that made Reagan exceptional. Number 8 is George Washington's Secret Six, The Spy Ring That Saved the American Revolution by Brian Kilmeade, the Fox News, Fox and Friends co-host, and it's just a great book about the Culper Ring, and if you're into AMC's turn, Washington Spies, it's much of what they talk about in the book is in the show. It's just fantastic. Number seven is In the Arena, Good Citizens, A Great Republic, and How One Speech Can Reinvigorate America. This is by Pete Hegseth, who is a Fox News contributor and decorated veteran, and has an interesting thesis that Theodore Roosevelt can make America great again, using a speech that he gave about active citizenship. He tried to make the case that you need an active and educated citizenry in order to have self-government, which is what we were talking about.
Yeah, you bet. I was thinking of an Irving Kristol quote that if you want self-government, you have to have selves worthy of governing. But
Exactly.
Go on.
Number six is And the Good News Is, Lessons and Advice from the Bright Side by Dana Perino, former Bush press secretary and Fox News co-host for The Five. And number five is Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win by Jocko Williams and Leif Babin. These are two Navy SEALs who actually served alongside Chris Kyle.
The American Sniper.
Famous, exactly. And they do something interesting. They take the ideas and things that they'd learned as Navy SEALs and apply them to business practices and how you can be successful in business using Navy SEAL ideas. So it's kind of interesting. Number four is Crippled America, How to Make America Great Again, which is by Donald Trump. It was his book that came out a little later last year as a way to try to explain more of his policy proposals that he was putting forward. Number three is actually the oldest book on our list. It's also by Donald Trump, Trump, The Art of the Deal. I guess there's just a lot of interest in, I think he's running for something.
No, but it goes to markets and it goes to people trying to understand the mind of the next president of the United States. Which invokes everything you said were your criteria, issues having to do with liberty, free markets, national defense, and civil society.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Number two is Killing Reagan, The Violent Assault That Changed a Presidency by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. And this book has had some controversy about it.
We know the controversy. We did a lot on that controversy. But nonetheless, people tell me that it's actually a very good read. I mean, we're mature enough to read things we don't necessarily agree with every part of.
Exactly. It's Killing Patton is probably my favorite in the series. How detailed he gets on many of the things that leads up to these incidents is quite amazing. I do have some disagreements, too, about Killing Reagan, and I think the people that disagree make some excellent points about that. But number one is, I think, one of the most uplifting, inspiring books that I've read this year so far. It's called Red Platoon, A True Story of American Valor. It's by Staff Sergeant Clinton Romesha. He was the leader of a band of 50 servicemen and women in Afghanistan in the most northern base camp that they had there that was surprisingly attacked 3 days before the base was going to close by 300 Taliban fighters. And it's in the same vein of Lone Survivor, 13 Hours, and American Sniper about how someone could overcome something like that. And it's just, we interviewed him on the Conservative Book Club in our podcast with him, and it's just a harrowing story. And it's so compelling, Seth, that their Sony Pictures has even bought the movie rights already, and the book just came out last week.
Wow.
So it's my one recommendation, Red Platoon. It's a heck of a read.
It dawns on me, if you just took that list of 10 as your summer reading and did two books a month or three books a month, you would be a very smart person. That would be a great way. We always talk in education. I know education policy a little bit. We always talk in education about what you lose over the summer because you're not staying on top of things. You're not learning through the summer. We take these 3 months off from learning. This would be a great way to not only continue the thread of learning, but actually perhaps increase the thread of learning that you would have had the other 9 months. That's a great list, Christopher.
Well, thank you. And our editorial board put it together, and they always do a very good job. And I agree with you, too. I think reading is just, it's so important. In the world that we live in the Twitterization of the world, you know, good literary content is hard to come by these days.
Yeah, it is. And I'm glad you guys are doing it. We're talking to Chris Malagisi at the Conservative Book Club, and you can go to the Conservative Book Club. conservativebookclub.com to get these things that he's talking about, including all the other fun stuff that's all around it. I want to ask you about this new book you just put out, because this is right up an alley I spend a lot of time on, Passing on the Right, Conservative Professors in the Progressive University. Can you say a word about that?
Oh, it's a very interesting book, and I will be up front that I have not finished reading it yet. Mm-hmm. I just learned about the book late last week. Some of your listeners might know Nicholas Kristof, who writes for the New York
Times. Yeah, we were quoting him the other day, you bet.
Yeah, and it was a very interesting op-ed.
Yes.
He cited this book in his article, in op-ed, and the basic thrust of it was that, for liberals, for all the talk about diversity and differing opinions, there really is a lack of conservative conservatives in the academy. Mm-hmm. They quoted some polls where self-identified professors said 9% of them consider themselves actually conservative. Well, I thought it was really interesting, 18% of them actually said that they identified as being Marxists.
Mm-hmm.
So double the amount of concern. Now, for a lot of people, they'd be like, no duh. I mean, yeah, we know that. But, I mean, it's very striking. And you had a liberal who was writing that op-ed saying that, wait a minute, we might even need an affirmative action program for conservative professors.
Yes.
And, it does really a disservice to the debate when you don't have other opinions participating in that. How can you ever challenge your ideology? It just becomes dogma if you don't have opposing opinions. And so Passing on the Right is two professors, Joshua Dunn and John Shields, did a lot of research in what might be the core reasons why there is this diversion in the academy.
I want to circle back to that on the break and tie that to the course you teach at American University. We'll be right back with Christopher Malagisi. Real delight to have the editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club. He does far more than just the Conservative Book Club, although it is all of a piece. It is a unification of the loves, the order amorum, as the classicists would say. And you were just, Christopher, before the break, talking about this book about conservatives in the university, the rare breed that they are. I often I lament that, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse, mm-hmm. generation over generation, to the point where, a lot of us can probably name six or seven conservative professors who aren't, who aren't at Hillsdale, let's say. No, that are right, that are at good and elite, top-notch universities. We all know about five or six of them. There aren't that many more, at least not prominent, at least not that we know of. And I struggle with some of this in this sense, because I know a lot of great conservative academics who simply just didn't even try. They just went straight to the think tank world, knowing how hard it would be to get into a tenured position, given their outlook, given their ideology. And once upon a time, it was a little easier. So I honestly don't think a Robert George or a Hadley Arkus could get tenure today. So much the worse for American education and students. I don't think a David Gelernter could get tenure today. We're talking about Amherst, Princeton, Yale. Mm-hmm. I don't think a Harvey Mansfield at Harvard could. You know the names as well as I do. It's a real tragedy, but I don't think they can or could.
It's tough. I was actually talking with some friends recently about this, and someone had a pretty interesting idea. Public universities are supposedly supposed to work for the state, right? There could be some progress that's made here by passing a small little bill that says that intellectual diversity will be allowed on campus and not be penalized in some way, shape, or form of that. And they were talking about, Stanley Kurtz has written about this too a little bit and talked about that perhaps on the state level we could start making some dents in this. But I, like you kind of joked about before, the Hillsdales of the world might be the alternative. There is this these new colleges that are rising up, Liberty, Regents, and Hillsdale. I mean, Hillsdale's been around for a long time.
Patrick Henry,
of course,
for sure. I'd add Patrick Henry to that list.
Patrick Henry, Grove City, Bob Jones. There's a lot of great universities that are out there, and that I don't think a lot of people know about them. And that, you know, there are choices for parents. And I think one of the other ideas we had come up with too is trying to do a ranking of intellectual freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, you got a list for the U.S. World Report rankings. They don't have one on intellectual speech. You don't need, like, the top 10 conservative universities, but, you know, offer alternative rankings to schools that would give parents some options, I guess.
I think it's a fantastic idea, and we're on exactly the same page when you talk about the public universities. It was just a little while ago, a few months ago, I was talking about governors exercising their rights, flexing their muscles in their roles as regents to these public universities. In 1967, Ronald Reagan, really one of Ronald Reagan's first act as the California governor, the newly inaugurated California governor, was to seek the firing of the head of the Regents, Clark Kerr. And the next day, the day after it, the San Francisco Chronicle headline was, Kerr out, Reagan wins. And this... Not, I don't want to say more than anything, but certainly first among equals helped establish Ronald Reagan nationally as a conservative hero. It was going after the universities. One wonders what a fight like that would look like today. So much more entrenched are the issues. But once upon a time it was done. And for those that like to look to Reagan as a model for things, that's a pretty good one.
I do, and I would love to see that fight, though I think I would need my own little safe space for that.
Yeah, no, of course, especially in well, we wouldn't expect Jerry Brown to do it, but but right, some of these new conservative and Republican governors could certainly look at that. You do more than books, by the way. You do movies. I want to talk about Captain America, but I want to talk about your class. What is on your reading list at the class? When you do the history of conservatism, I assume you use the Nash book. What other books do you use?
Oh, you run my mind. Yeah, the George Nash's The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America Since 1945 is their...
It's the Bible, isn't it?
It's timeless. It's wonderful. And I recently talked with George Nash, and he told me that was actually his senior thesis in college. I can't even imagine what... You don't get writing like that every day, but that's kind of like the main text that we use to kind of introduce the students to the philosophical underpinnings of conservatism. The next book we use is Lee Edwards, who is the Distinguished Scholar of Conservative Thought at the Heritage Foundation. He wrote a book called The Conservative Revolution, The Movement That Remade America. And it's a great book about the political history of the conservative movement. So it's nice to have the Nash and Edwards books work together to explain both the political and the philosophical. I do sprinkle in a little of Bastiat, a little of Hayek, a little of Kirk and Friedman, and a little of Chambers through different readers. It's tough to, you don't want to sign too many books because they won't read them if you do too much, give too much. But a lot of what Nash and Edwards talks about in their books give an explanation of who Whitaker Chambers was. Why was the book Witness a big deal? Why did the Alger Hiss situation come about? And, you know, we try to reach all those different things from individual passages from each. And of course, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
Not bad, that. We're going into a break. I'm curious. I'll just throw it out there. Maybe we can throw it around when we come back. I'm curious, when you mentioned Witness and Chambers, if that is, and there may be no way to actually answer this question, but I'm wondering if that is the most sold, the most popular, the most purchased conservative book since World War II. I'm just wondering. Don't answer it. Think about it. There may not be a right answer to that. And we'll do it with Christopher Malagisi from the Conservative Book Club when we come back.
I just called to say I want you to come back home.
Delighted to have with us Christopher Malagisi, Professor Malagisi. He is the editor-in-chief of the Conservative Book Club, and has been our guest for this hour, talking about everything in the conservative movement, including books. And we're going to talk about movies, too, in a moment. You can go to his website or their website at conservativebookclub.com. Chris, I threw out a question that I don't know if there is an answer to, but it dawns on me in the last segment I asked you, what might be the biggest selling conservative book in the history since World War II? I'm wondering if it might not be Witness by Whitaker Chambers.
You know, that is, Seth, that is a great question. What I have heard and from what I have known, I think the greatest selling conservative book has been Barry Goldwater.
I was just going to say, maybe Conscience of a Conservative. Yeah, yeah.
I think in just a few years ago, it surpassed, 4.5 million copies sold.
Yeah, okay. My buddy Shattuck out here is happy for that. Okay, all right, is very happy about that. But Witness has to be up there, right? Witness would have to be up there. Road to Serfdom would have to be up there, I think.
Mm-hmm. And we do have actually a conservative classic section on the Conservative Book Club that has information on all these books that are there. But yeah, no, definitely. I mean, if you look at the original conservative coalition of libertarians or classical liberals, anti-communists and traditionalists, definitely for the libertarian classical liberals, you'd have The Road to Serfdom by Hayek, the Milton Friedman, of course, and for the anti-communists, I don't think you could really have an anti-communist movement without Whitaker Chambers's book, Witness. I think it should be required reading for everybody to read his introduction to his book called Letters to My Children, and it was just a beautiful argument about why communism really is evil. And it's a struggle that's not just a military struggle. This was for Western civilization, whether or not that it would survive. Yep. And I assume you've read it or definitely know about
sure.
it. But for your readers, that if you really want to get a fundamental understanding of why we fought the Cold War, I think it's required reading for everybody. Just to at least read the introduction.
Yeah, and I don't remember. Yeah, just that introduction in and of itself is very famous. And I don't remember if it was in his book or not. I know it was in his correspondence with William Buckley that he thought he was joining the losing side by joining the American side.
He did, and Buckley and him had a great correspondence, and he wrote for National Review later on after the infamous trial. And he died, unfortunately, in 1953 at relatively somewhat young age.
Yeah.
And it would have been kind of interesting to see years after how he would have helped form the post-World War II conservative movement. I think he would have played a huge part.
I think so, too. And it would have been interesting to see what school of foreign policy he might have helped develop. We have these various conservative schools of foreign policy, kind of Kissingerian or realism mm-hmm. versus perhaps neoconservatism. It would be very interesting to have known that. And we know, of course, never will. I neglected, as you were mentioning it, I said Hayek, but certainly Free to Choose by Milton Friedman had to have been up there. I don't remember seeing houses, even liberal houses growing up, that didn't have that book in it. probably a Russell Kirk book.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to remember the name of that big one he did.
The Conservative Mind.
The Conservative Mind, right. That would have been up there. What was the biggest book Buckley wrote? Do you think that was his first book?
God and Man at Yale put him on the map. Yeah. It came out in 1951. He was just 26 years old, just graduated from Yale, and basically was pretty much set for life. I mean, when you went to Harvard or Yale or any of those big Ivy League schools in the 1940s and 50s, I mean, you were set for life. And what does this guy do? He graduates from college, and the first thing he does is write how awful his school is, how godless and socialist it was becoming. And for a 26-year-old young articulate guy, it put him on the map.
Yeah.
And I think if he wrote so many other books, but that's the one that if you really want to get a window into this conservative movement icon, it's a great one to start with. His autobiography, too, is just an unbelievable autobiography. He talks about his life, but he does it in a way where he tells it through short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Just another fantastic read.
What would his autobiography have been? I'm just not familiar with it. You mean like those books he did, like Cruising Speed, or something more recent?
But it was called Miles Gone By.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Miles Gone By. I, of course, know that book. I had forgotten of that as an auto. Because he puts himself in so much of his writing, like Christopher Hitchens. I had not thought of it as an autobiography. But, yes, that is a tremendous read. Miles Gone By.
He refused to do a straightforward chronological biography. Right. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to do it through short stories. And it's interesting because when you read it, if you know anything about Bill Buckley, I mean, there's a lot to admire about him, but what he writes about is these stories that kind of made a big difference in his life. Mm-hmm. And it's even from the big, you know, the big things that he did, starting National Review and et cetera, but also the small things. There's just in how he learned to love wine and how he learned to play the harpsichord and how he learned to sail, which is some interesting stuff you don't usually get when you get a Buckley bio somewhere.
No, that's right. And, you know, we use the phrase probably too much and almost water it down by overuse. Renaissance man. He really was one. When you read any of these books of his, you can't help but marvel at the breadth of his interests, from being a master sailor, a real sailor, to a musician, a harpsichordist, to a gifted expert on the language. I knew he grew up speaking Spanish. I'm not sure if English was a second language to him or not, but he certainly was bilingual and certainly had a love for Latin and other languages. Just a tremendous Renaissance man, the likes of which we don't see anymore, probably because we don't see education like people like that got anymore. As we go back to the topic we started out on in the very first segment. We're going into a break, Christopher, and then we just have one more very short segment, but I couldn't let it go by because you also did a movie review of the week. It's getting a lot of attention, Captain America. I'm wondering if we come back just in a minute or two, if you might give us a pressie on this new movie, Captain America. Would that be okay?
Of course.
Be right back with more from Christopher Malagisi of the Conservative Book Club. Boy, it dawns on me, when you think about the culture, you think about a lot of things. You think certainly about books and publishing and good writing. You think about education, the university. Those are two things our guest for this past hour, Christopher Malagisi, is entrenched in. He's a professor and he is a editor-in-chief for a book club. And he also is here to talk with us a little bit about a movie review, Hollywood movies. That's a big part of the culture, too. Captain America. I'm very excited to go see this, especially since I saw Vanity Fair take a swipe at the masculinity portrayed in it. But the first time I was brought attention to this, my attention was brought to this, Chris, was in the first Avengers, where he takes out his old uniform. Do you remember the scene? And he says to the head of the organization, he says, "Little old-fashioned, perhaps," and his boss says, "We could use a little old-fashioned right now." I loved that. I loved that. We could use a little old-fashioned right now. Give us this movie review, brother.
Well, you know, if you're a fan of the superhero movies genre, this is everything that you want and more. I haven't enjoyed a film about superheroes since the Dark Knight trilogy, and I think out of all of the ones that they've made so far, I think the Captain America ones stand out, not just because of the name of the superhero, but there tends to be a theme in the Avengers world of almost like an individualism, standing apart from the crowd, being able to self-govern and be of oneself. And this movie in particular, Civil War, is just a larger extension of that. And the basic thesis of it is that the United Nations wants to have jurisdiction over all the activities of the Avengers. And the camp gets split up into two groups of for it or against it. And the UN's using the justification because of the collateral damage that's been done by all the crime fighting that they've done. So on one side, you got Captain America, who doesn't want to be under the jurisdiction of the UN and makes the case that why would we put ourselves under foreign control when their judgment of right and wrong can shift depending on the time. And you had, ironically, you had Iron Man, somebody who was the rebel who just felt kind of aging a little bit, getting a little tired, that maybe they shouldn't have as much freedom as they have in doing the crime fighting that they're doing. So the movie starts from that premise, and obviously when you're watching it, you just can't help but think, man, there's, you know, the Sea Treaty, the UN Court of Justice, and all these things that liberals have for years been trying to get us to sign on to, and you just couldn't help that this is just like one other aspect of it. So I actually think it's this unapologetic defense of American sovereignty and explores the relationship between the individual and the state. And it's just a heck of a lot of fun, too.
I mean, you get
to have all the superheroes in one movie, and it's not watered down, and it's everything you wished Batman versus Superman would have been.
Perfect.
So it is the summer movie in every way, shape, and form, and if you do get a chance, it's definitely worth the seeing.
Hey, Chris, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time and your thoughts. Don't be a stranger.
Thanks, Seth. I appreciate it.
Have a good night.